The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Welcome to We the People.
I think when we're here on time, we mix up Bob.
Everything's confusing then.
We give him too much time.
No, I was talking to our guests.
Nice drive, Bill.
Talking to our guests' answering machine, which was not a good sign.
Little snafu. And hey, if you clicked on our webpage, wethepeopleradio.us, depends on how you clicked on it, you might have gotten last week's show. Sorry. I'm in the process of waiting for my computer to come up so that I can fix that for you. In the meantime, our phone number is 530-605-4567. My name is Erin. We've got Bill, and we have Bob. Those are our choices today.
I'm Bill. He's Bob.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Hopefully that's our guest. Yeah, either that or somebody really had us on speed dial already.
Yeah, it's always kind of frightening when the guest doesn't answer the phone.
Before Frank gets on here, we got a cool show today, actually. Frank is with the Center. Make sure I get this right. The Center for Security Policy, and their site is securefreedom.org. Frank does all the briefing, well, not all of it, but he does a lot of briefing for Congress on the issue of Islam, political Islam, I should say, and the Muslim Brotherhood specifically.
That's right. The inside track, the real deal.
The real inside track. And for those of you who were on last week, got to tell you, we had staggering numbers. Just through the website, people going on last Sunday, it was like 480 people. We had 1,300 throughout the week, and I'm looking to see how that changes. I haven't really used the analyzing stuff that tells how many people are logging in. So that doesn't count all of you that listen on the radio in other ways, but kind of exciting. What's going on over there, Bob?
Frank is going to call us back on a landline.
Oh, okay. That's kind of snazzy. I hadn't talked to him yet, so I was really hoping that we didn't have a snafu. It's really bad when you shoot out the reminder to his assistant, and it comes back, I will be out of the office until Monday and unreachable by phone.
No.
That's exactly it. He gave me some other guy. In the event of an emergency, contact Sean. I'm like, Sean, please.
We don't want Sean. We want Frank.
I wanted Sean. I wanted Sean to give me Frank's phone number. Oh, my gosh. So,
So we'll be talking about the Muslim Brotherhood and how they're
infiltrating everything we have. And
yeah, and believe me, they are. We've got some real good inside intel. And
we went through this explanatory memorandum from the archives of the Muslim Brotherhood, and apparently we got a whole bunch of documents from them. Well, not from them.
Well, this is
about
actually
them.
The same material Congress is briefed on right here. This is the stuff that our government is now aware of.
Has been aware of it for a while, although we don't seem to ever get the feeling that they're really aware of it. We keep putting people in positions of power that have, as it turns out, links to the Muslim Brotherhood. But we'll find out how much of that's really going on.
They're just here to explain themselves and, you know, and work with us.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's a partnership.
Yeah. It's a partnership.
It's a magical courtship we're having.
Yeah. They speak and we do it.
So, wethepeopleradio.us, if you go there to the homepage and you clicked on this week on Sunday, it sent you to last week. Sorry. Go back to the top of the page, click March 8th, and you should be seeing Frank Gaffney with the Center for Security Policy. And what's going on over there, Bob? There's a lot of activity over on Bob's side. We're kind of distracted. We're trying to listen to him and talk to you.
We're negotiating the time.
Oh, okay, that's fine.
We have him for an hour and 15 minutes. Well, we have him for an hour and 5 minutes now.
Nice. So what did we start with? 45 minutes and you bumped him up?
Basically, yes. Yes.
Good job, Bob. I just wanted to, give you some kudos there.
I thought you had said 2 hours.
Well, so that's what Jordy said. But see, Jordy's the guy who's gone till Monday, so we can't even get a hold of him. Oh, my gosh. Okay, so Frank Gaffney is the founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C. The center is a not-for-profit, nonpartisan educational corporation established in 1988. Under Mr. Gaffney's leadership, the center has been nationally and internationally recognized as a resource for timely, informed, and penetrating analysis of foreign and defense policy matters. How's that? So we have Frank in there.
Good afternoon, Frank.
Hi.
Hi. So we've never talked to you before. We have.
I appreciate very much your allowing me to speak to you today, and a little less at length than might otherwise have been desirable. I do apologize for that.
No sweat. You know, I mean, everybody's in a state of flux today with this stupid daylight savings time.
Yes.
Unless you live in Arizona where they just get to have regular time all the time, which is cool.
A bunch of nonconformists down there.
I love that. So we read your memorandum and a couple other things that you had presented at a congressional breakfast, I guess, a couple of months ago.
Mm-hmm.
Really spooky, actually. We did not, however, read the entire thing to our audience. So whatever you would like to tell them, the floor is yours.
Well, I think you're referring to a memorandum that was actually written by a very senior member of a group called the Muslim Brotherhood.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Muhammad Akram. It was written back in 1991 as a kind of report to the mothership in Egypt from one of the senior operatives of the group in the United States. Its formal title is The Explanatory Memorandum on the General Strategic Goal of the Group in North America. And it's available for free, by the way, if people want to check it out, at our website, which is securefreedom.org. Just look under books and you'll see the explanatory memorandum. It's very easy reading. It runs to about 40 pages, as I recall. But what it lays out, and don't take my word for it, this is what the federal government said of it when they introduced it into evidence in the Holy Land Foundation trial, the largest terrorism financing trial in U.S. history, that it was the strategic plan of the Muslim Brotherhood to implement what the brother Muhammad Akram called the mission statement of the Brotherhood in North America, which is as follows, quote, eliminating and destroying Western civilization from within, sabotaging its miserable house by their hands, by which they meant ours, the infidels, unquote, and the hands of the believers, so that God's religion is made victorious over all other religions, unquote. In other words, they are engaged in an explicitly seditious campaign to overthrow the government of the United States and to replace our Constitution with a program they call Sharia, a supremacist, brutally totalitarian, anti-woman, anti-gay, apostate, anti-artist program that now is unfortunately becoming more known to us as a result of what groups like the Islamic State or Boko Haram or the Taliban or Al-Shabaab or the Al-Nusra Front or so many others, all of whom basically got their start with the teachings and in some cases with the alumni of the Muslim Brotherhood, which shares their objective of two things. One, imposing Sharia, this doctrine, worldwide, and two, creating conditions under which there will be a new form of government that will rule according to Sharia, and they call it a caliphate. So this is the blueprint, if you will, for what the Muslim Brotherhood has in mind for all of us, and they proceed in the rest of this memorandum to talk about how they are going about actually actually implementing this program inside our country through the penetration and subversion of our civil society institutions and our government.
One of the things I found really interesting after reading this was their concept of settlement and how their plan is to establish a settlement in this country in order to take over our civilization, basically.
Lots of things about putting down roots.
Yeah, roots. What, and I was kind of hoping you'd talk a little bit about how they plan on establishing the settlement and some of the organizations that are already here and doing business right under our noses and helping them establish their settlement. I found that pretty fascinating.
You know, what's interesting, really, is that this is very much of a piece with a kind of program that the communists used back in the Cold War.
Yes.
To achieve a similar kind of end, namely subversion of our government and our civil society institutions. They of course, weren't trying to bring about Sharia. They wanted to bring about, you know, the triumph of the proletariat and all of that. But the method is similar, in penetration and subversion. But what you have as an overlay on this particular sort of totalitarian playbook is, as you say, a process of settlement, by which they mean bringing large numbers of their co-religionists into the United States for the purpose of changing our demographics, for the purpose of creating conditions under which they can become more and more aggressive, more and more assertive, not assimilating, but seeking to carve out initially in their own enclaves and then ultimately expand more broadly their agenda. And it's laid out in considerable detail in this 1991 memorandum. By the way, this document, I always think this is important to explain to people because it's kind of a jaw-dropper. We weren't supposed to know this.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we would never ordinarily have gotten our hands on a document like this, except for what I can only describe as an act of providence. And that is, back in 2004, 13 years after this thing was written, you had the an alert Maryland Transportation Authority police officer noticing that a couple driving back and forth across a major artery out in this neck of the woods, the Chesapeake Bay Bridge, the woman in this couple was doing what a lot of people, as they drive across that beautiful expanse, do, and took out a camera and took photographs. Only the officer noticed that she wasn't taking pictures of the scenery. She was taking pictures of the structural supports of the bridge.
Oops.
And he thought that didn't look right. So he pulled them over and he ran their IDs, and lo and behold, the driver in the car, who was her husband, was a fellow by the name of Ismael El Barassa, who was wanted on a material witness arrest warrant for fundraising in Chicago for a designated terrorist group called Hamas. And when law enforcement discovered what this guy was doing and where he was, the FBI was given a search warrant for their home in another suburb of Washington, D.C., called Annandale, Virginia. And when the FBI executed that search warrant, they discovered below the basement a secret sub-basement in which were 80 banker boxes worth of documents, including this one, that made up basically the archives of the Muslim Brotherhood in America.
So they were well underway at that point. I mean,
Well, it started basically back in 1962 with the establishment of their first front organization called the Muslim Students Association, which is, by the way, on, by some estimates, 500 American campuses now.
Wow.
Lovely. That explains a lot, though.
But
well,
just,
it does. It gives you a sense of what I really am concerned about, as much as I am the violent kind of jihad, which is much in evidence these days, sadly. Fortunately, mostly elsewhere, but increasingly there's evidence that they're trying to bring it here. But there's also this so-called civilization jihad. And as you say, the process of settlement is designed to expand the population that helps advance this agenda, and the Muslim Brotherhood seeks to control it. And if they have their way, the combination of the violent kind of jihad and the threat of it and this subversive influence operation will really undo our constitutional freedoms and ultimately our country.
Yeah, and this document pretty much lines out the polar opposite of what our Constitution is about. And, you know, when you talk about settlements, look at Dearborn, Michigan. I mean, there's an example of settlement.
And the thing that's disturbing is we appear to be rolling over for this. Is that what you see, Frank?
I wish it were just that we were rolling over. I'm afraid when you look at it, you know, a little bit more concretely, you'll see that we, meaning specifically our government, is
right.
Actually enabling it. And what they're doing in that regard is they have this sounds incredible, but it's true. They have really turned over to the United Nations the responsibility for deciding who qualifies as a refugee for admission into this country. And the United Nations is largely, at this point, in the thrall of a group that most Americans have never heard of, but that is a hugely influential force within the United Nations circles because of its large number of members. It has 56 states plus Palestine. They rounded up to 57, but I'm an old-fashioned guy saying Palestine is not a state, and I hope it will never be. But those 56 or 57 nations, if you will, are not only a large block of the United Nations membership, but quite a number of them are very wealthy as well. They're big OPEC nations, for example. And they've been able to use their money and their numbers to dominate things like the UN High Commission on Refugee Affairs. And as a result, what we are getting by way of refugees disproportionately these days are Muslims. And that's not necessarily a problem unless they are Muslims who wish to advance this Sharia program, who have no interest in assimilating, who seek to essentially establish, as I say, initially their own enclaves or ultimately no-go zones, and in due course to exercise greater and greater dominion over the rest of us. And this is an enabling of the process of settlement, what they call the Al-Hijra phenomenon. Dar al-Hijra is the house of Al-Hijra. But it's an immigration jihad, if you will, and combined with the institutionalized jihad of the OIC and the United Nations, it constitutes quite a dangerous force.
Well, how do we know the difference? See, I don't. Based on what I know about their belief system and their the idea that the goal is to infiltrate our culture and take it over, how do we know who the good guys are and who the bad guys are? Because how can you have good guys in a deal like that?
It's a great question, and it's a tough one, because I think the good guys are largely cowed into being silent. And the bad guys, who would have you believe they're good guys, are not only quite adept at lying about their true intentions, but it is actually their duty to do so under Sharia. And this is something that is very much foreign to most other faiths and religious practices under Sharia. And I'm not saying this is true of all Muslims. Let me hasten to add, I don't think that a great many Muslims who don't want to live under Sharia, don't want to impose it on anybody else, are the problem. The problem is those who do. And there are lots of them, and unfortunately they are backed up by the authorities of the faith. And the authorities of the faith tell them that it is not only permissible to lie for the faith if it's necessary to advance its purposes, but it is actually their duty to do it. It's called taqiyya in Arabic, and it's a very established practice, and it makes quite complicated the question that you've just asked. I would tell you the short answer is, I think if you apply the test of, are you dealing with people who embrace Sharia, who want to have it be the world's, you know, legal system and political code, they are problems. And if you are dealing with Muslims who don't, typically they are more secular, or they are certainly more assimilating in our country, then they are not, at least at the moment, the problem. And you just need to get smart about what, you know, Sharia is about, so that you can help differentiate between the two.
Yeah, and see, that's the problem.
Yeah, the idea that we can have, you know, Sharia courts and things like that in this country, and that it's no big deal. It's just about their faith. Like, that's just crazy.
Well, it's quite a sophisticated play, actually, if you think about it.
Yeah, they use religion.
Under our system of government, of course, our constitution makes explicit that we respect religious freedom. And what the Brotherhood and its ilk have figured out is, if they simply masquerade their political program as a religion, and Sharia, you know, has some, maybe 10% by some estimates of its regulations and codes and instructions and so on, dealing with, you know, pietistic practice, how you pray, in which direction you pray, what you wash, what you eat, and all the rest. But the rest of it is basically about power. It is a code of conduct. It tells you how you are to interact with everybody, from your women folk to your families more generally, to your neighbors, to your community, to, you know, your God and country. This is why I think it is a terrible mistake to allow them to call Sharia just their religious practice. It is, in fact, seditious, and we need to brand it as such.
Yeah, and see, that's the polar opposite of our Constitution.
It's a political doctrine.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They can't coexist, can they, Frank?
I think objectively they cannot, and when you wonder about that, I would suggest take a look at the legal code and its practice in, say, Saudi Arabia. And if you think that is pretty much the way our Constitution works, then, you know, you could arguably think that it's going to all work out. Anybody with a lick of sense knows that the law as practiced in Saudi Arabia, with you know, the most barbaric of punishments, lashes and amputations for petty crimes, no freedoms, none of the freedoms that, you know, are enshrined in our Constitution are allowed to be practiced there. Honor killings, you know, beheadings, and the rest. I mean, these are the sorts of things that I don't think any American would tolerate for a moment. And yet, you do hear some saying, oh, no, Sharia is consistent with our Constitution. I find that they fall into two categories. One is that they're people who simply don't know what they're talking about, on the one hand. Or, if you're hearing that kind of line from somebody who is reportedly a leader of the Muslim community, that almost always means that they're Muslim brothers, because they've paid to be the leaders of the community. They've built the infrastructure. They've exercised dominion over it. And they know exactly what they're talking about, which is taqiyya. That is not true, and it cannot be true. Our Constitution is a totally different concept than their program.
And wouldn't that be a good way to identify, I don't know, the anti-American Muslims, if you find the ones that want to defend or promote Sharia?
Well, it can be. I think if you're able to discern, and again, this requires some education, so I really commend to you some materials that are available at the Center for Security Policy to help in becoming knowledgeable about all of this. But it's important, once you've established that these individuals are actually committed to Sharia, and I don't mean simply that they think it kind of is an abstract path that they follow or in their practice of the faith that they observe and pay lip service to. I'm talking about people who really think this is the way that all things in the world must be ordered and that everyone must conform to it, Muslim and non-Muslim alike. Well, when you find that fault line, then you've got a basis upon which I think you can, yes, differentiate folks who are problematic from folks who are not.
All right, we're going to take a really quick break and come right back with Frank Gaffney from the Center for Security Policy. And maybe when we come back, you can talk to us about how our present administration's interacting with the Muslim Brotherhood. Is that an on-topic thing?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, because we're super curious about it, and we know you've got the skinny there. Join us at WeThePeopleRadio.us for all the information, link to Frank's website, and join us on the chat room. It's a great place to ask questions. This is KCNR, 1460 AM. The old nails at the bottom of the sea. Poor Bob. His music program blew up right when he was ready to come back. Deal breaker. We had some fun music. Lost all his songs. Darn it. All right. We're here with Frank Gaffney from the Center for Security Policy. I would encourage you to join us online at WeThePeopleRadio.us. You can click on the chat room there. You've got all the information about Frank, links to his website, and there's a ton of information there. Just an absolute ton. So Frank, the burning question is, are all the things that we get in our email all the time about how our government is basically working with the Muslim Brotherhood and helping them?
Probably not
a good true or false question, but maybe you could...
No, it is true that our government has been working with and I think enabling the Muslim Brotherhood both in Egypt, where, as we've discussed, they are founded, and in this country as well. One of the things that you can find at that website, securefreedom.org, is a course. Actually, another way of finding it is MuslimBrotherhoodInAmerica.com. And this course, which is a 10-part series, about 8 hours long, so it requires a bit of investment in time, but I think well worth it, is an opportunity to really go to school on who the Muslim Brotherhood is, how it operates, including the ways that we were talking about before the break, who has been enabling it, which includes, I'm sorry to say, to many people's surprise, in conservative circles, a fellow by the name of Grover Norquist. And we lay out the ways in which, starting back in 1998, and when he joined forces with an individual by the name of Abdurrahman Alamoudi, at the time was a top Muslim Brotherhood operative, to create what amounted to an influence operation against conservatives and the GOP for the Muslim Brotherhood called the Islamic Free Market Institute. That operation has been continuing today. It really explains, I think, what happened to George W. Bush when he was induced to make certain statements and associate with certain individuals that were very troubling, including statements like Islam is a religion of peace and jihad is just about personal struggle. And the people who are trying to hijack those planes on 9/11 were also trying to hijack a great Abrahamic faith and so on. The reason that he was surrounded by Muslim brothers and the reason that he made those sorts of statements, which are unfortunately not true, is, I think, a result of, in part at least, the successful influence operation to which he was subjected by Grover Norquist and his associates. Today, under the Obama administration, things are substantially worse. I think that the president himself has set the tone with his desire to and involvement in the legitimation of the Muslim Brotherhood. He has had a number of top Brotherhood operators in the White House consulting with him personally, including one by the name of Mohammed Majid, an imam who, for a time until recently, led the largest Muslim Brotherhood front in the United States. It's called the Islamic Society of North America, or ISNA. And a number of these operators have been either employed by the Obama administration or have been given key advisory roles and have, I'm afraid, greatly exacerbated the problem that, you know, we saw under George W. Bush to the point where we helped overthrow a government in Egypt that was friendly, not perhaps a perfect ally, but certainly friendly, in favor of the Muslim Brotherhood. And when it was in turn overthrown by the demands of the people of Egypt, some 35 million of whom turned out to get rid of them in the streets of Cairo and other cities, we've done everything we can to try to undermine the successor government of President al-Sisi and to see what can be done to bring the Muslim Brotherhood back. And similarly, we're watching a lot of aiding and abetting of the influence operators of the Muslim Brotherhood and other Islamist groups inside the United States as well.
Does calling it all these different names, is that just part of the bamboozling technique? You know, to keep changing the names of them. They're Al-Qaeda, they're all these other things, and they're good. Oh, no, wait, they're bad, but they've split off. Now they're somebody else. Is that really happening, or is it really just the same guys?
Well, it's a little hard to say. I think there are genuinely some differences among different factions, kind of like the mafia.
Okay.
They're all in agreement on the basic principle, and they're all working towards the same end, which is our destruction. But they do have differences as to who should lead the fight and who ought to be on top and all the rest. And so I think that some of the name changing is tactical, but an awful lot of it has to do with you know, the personal ambitions of those involved. But we shouldn't kid ourselves. Whether it's the Islamic State, which is the, you know, the group that we're supposed to focus on at the moment, or Boko Haram, or the Taliban, or Al-Qaeda Central, or Al-Qaeda Core.
That's what I mean.
You know, they all want exactly the same thing as the Muslim Brotherhood. As I said, it's our destruction. It's the replacement of our form of government with theirs, which is a more or less theocratic type with Sharia at its core.
Frank, have we actually, you know, we've had a hand in bringing down Libya and attempting to bring down Syria. Is that aiding the Muslim Brotherhood in those regions? I mean, is it helping them take more control of that region?
Well, what we've seen, certainly, since Muammar Gaddafi was overthrown in Libya and with the revolution against Bashar Assad in Syria, is the rise of Islamism. And whether it's the Muslim Brotherhood or whether it's one of these other factions is less important than is the point that they are very much seeking and making considerable headway in replacing governments that that are more or less stable, and in the case of Muammar Gaddafi at least, and certainly Hosni Mubarak of Egypt, friendly to the United States, with governments that that seek to establish the caliphate, be part of it, or at least advance the global jihad. And this is why we use the term global jihad movement, really, to describe what we're up against, because I think it's much more accurate and less prone to misunderstanding than this other, you know, approach du jour.
Does the Muslim Brotherhood, I mean, as a whole, with Muslims in that area or in that region, how much influence do they actually have in all these countries? I mean, is it huge, or are they a small faction?
It varies from country to country. I think in most places, the Muslim Brotherhood membership is a relatively small proportion of the population. But in a way, that's deceiving. History is replete with examples of small groups that have three characteristics. They're disciplined, they're organized, and they're ruthless, wielding grossly disproportionate influence over others. Frequently, they will take and hold power despite their small numbers simply because of those attributes, particularly the ruthlessness piece. The Muslim Brotherhood has also proven adept, as it did in Egypt, to take its organizational skills and its discipline and translate them into electoral victory at the ballot box. But it's very clear that it's, as they say, one man, one vote, one time that they have in mind. It is not out of a commitment to democracy. It is rather to use it simply to get through the ballot what they would be unable to get through the gun. But once they've got power, they will hold on to it unless removed at the point of a gun, as was true in Egypt. And so I think that what we're dealing with, on the one hand, is a relatively small group, but having said that, there are populations synthetic. They believe it's God's will that Sharia will be imposed worldwide. They believe that it is the highest duty of a Muslim to engage in some kind of jihad, if not the violent kind, then the stealthy kind. If not the stealthy or violent kind, then you're still obliged to help by providing material support. So these groups are not the entirety of the problem. And having said that they can be very formidable even with small numbers, when they're able to draw upon larger numbers in many of these countries who think that killing apostates is in fact perfectly legitimate, who think that women should be considered as chattel, subject to, you know, their male relatives' whims. They think that homosexuals should be killed. They think that anybody who offends them by, you know, a cartoon of the Prophet or a video or anything else they don't like, should get the death penalty. I mean, these are things that are unfortunately in large swaths of the Middle East considered to be, you know, the popular will.
And that's not necessarily Sharia, though, is it?
All of what I just said is Sharia, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's all right. The same stuff. Same, too, with London and Paris. And, I mean, the Brits have been pretty, I don't know. I mean, they didn't want to offend anybody, so they kind of let them mushroom their idea into parts of London, and now they have no-go zones that are really big.
Well, there's a lot of controversy about that term. Suffice it to say that, as in parts of Dearborn, in this country, only more so, you have ghettos, effectively, that are considered to be too dangerous for the authorities to go in, at least other than in force, and they don't stay, as a general rule. And by and large, yes, these are enclaves that are now governed by Sharia, not by the laws of the land. That's not yet the case in Dearborn, I think, but it's coming. And, you know, most of what we've talked about thus far may sound to your audience as impossible or just so improbable as not to be something to worry about. I would say to them, lest you sort of ignore a real and present danger, and certainly a growing one, look at Europe. Because, as you say, and it's not just in London or in the UK, it's on the continent as well. Not just the violent kind of jihad that we saw with Charlie Hebdo in the Jewish deli. It's rife throughout Europe that you see folks using either violence or the threat of violence or the civilization jihad to change these Western societies into ones that, first of all, accommodate at every turn the demands of the Islamists, and at worst, you know, are increasingly allowing themselves to be dictated to by these guys as what is technically called dhimmis, that is to say, sort of second-class citizens. It's very frightening. It's alarming larger and larger numbers of Europeans, I think, as they see what's developing. And it should be a cautionary note to us as well.
Yeah, because at this point they're kind of fighting off their back foot, trying to get control of this thing again. Frank, I've got a copy of the Secure Freedom Strategy, a plan for victory over the global jihad movement. And one of the things that's said in here is, putting a counter-strategy into practice will require, first and foremost, identifying the Muslim Brotherhood for the explicitly jihadist organization it has always been, continuing to treat its operatives and organizations, overt and covert, in America and overseas as partners, because we're told their eschew violence is a formula for incremental destruction. Talk to us a little bit about the plan for turning this around and getting control again in our country.
Yeah, and shutting this off.
What we came up with was basically a strategy we call the Secure Freedom Strategy, and again, people can find it online for free at securefreedom.org.
It's a very interesting document, too. I highly recommend it.
Thank you. Well, it's interesting in part because I think there's increasingly a recognition that we don't have a good plan today for dealing with these guys. And really, much of what we've been talking about so far is at the core of it. We can't even identify these guys. The president refuses to use the term Islam or Islamic State or Jihad or Sharia, let alone in any combination with terrorism. And that's now become government policy. Mm-hmm. Nobody's allowed to say those words. Nobody's allowed to train our first lines of defense, whether it's our military or our intelligence community or the FBI or our Homeland Security officials, to understand these threats, let alone to counter them effectively. So part of our strategy is at its core about getting clearly calibrated that we are up against a global jihad movement and that Sharia is its ideological wellspring, and to defeat this enemy, we're going to have to recognize and come up with effective means of countering an ideological totalitarian movement.
How big a deal do you think it is?
What we found was so, just if I may, very quickly, what we found was so palpably helpful in thinking about how to do that is to look at the strategy that President Reagan used. Back in the Cold War, I had the privilege of serving under him in the Reagan Defense Department and played a small, very small role in the implementation of this strategy. But it was his purpose explicitly to defeat Soviet communism. And the strategy that he mapped out for doing that was spelled out in a secret document called National Security Decision Directive 75. And what a little tiger team that we put together at the Center for Security Policy came up with was basically adapting that strategy to today's totalitarian ideology, which, like the Soviet communists, as we said before, sought and is now seeking, in this case, our destruction.
How big a deal do you think it is that our present administration is unwilling to call this by its name? You know, a lot of people think that that's just media hype, that they keep saying that this is a big deal. And obviously, you know, the bulk of our mainstream media follows along. But is that a big deal, do you think?
I think it's a very big deal for the reason that I've just mentioned. I think that if you cannot identify and know your enemy and, you know, put yourself in a position to thereby figure out how to defeat it, chances are you will not defeat it.
Well, it kind of signals to them that we're not really opposed. I mean, we're not really calling them out, as they say.
Well, at the very least, what it conveys to them is what we may describe as political correctness,
mm-hmm.
or as multiculturalism, or as diversity, sensitivity, what have you. They have another term for it. They conceive what we're doing when we refuse to name them, when we refuse to acknowledge what they're about, when we refuse to develop an effective strategy for countering them, is something they call submission. And of course, that's the literal meaning of the word Islam, and in their, you know, religious DNA, namely the Quran, it is very explicit that your appropriate response when the infidel is submitting is, quote, to make them feel subdued, unquote. And what that means, basically, is you are supposed to redouble the effort to ensure that the submissive infidels understand that that is their permanent lot in life. They will never be other than your slaves, your dhimmis, your, you know, second-class or third-class citizens. And you know how that gets done? Well, as a practical matter, the way they make us feel subdued is by terrifying violence. So far from actually making this situation any better, when we try to pull our punches or not give offense or pretend that, you know, they're not who they are, and who they say they are, by the way, is to really actually give them the green light to think that this is the moment to press forward with more of their violent jihad against us.
Not helpful, and not a good plan. And I just don't see any end to it at this point. You know, we've got all these organizations. I know we have a quick break here with the news at the top of the hour, but maybe when we come back, you could talk to us about some of the organizations, especially here in the United States, that are posing as just friendly little, you know, they're not political, they're not trying to bring Sharia, and they completely are.
Sure, be happy to.
Yeah, you had a pretty good list. And I want to know about CARE, the CARE people, because they're on all the time, and they... Anyway, we'd like to get the 411 on CARE, please.
Sure.
We will be right back with Frank Gaffney from the Center for Security Policy. Their mission is to identify challenges and opportunities likely to affect American security, broadly defined, and to act properly and creatively to ensure that they are the subject of focused national examination and effective action. How do you go wrong there? We've got Frank for a few minutes after the top of the hour. Stay tuned in. We're at WeThePeopleRadio.us at KCNR 1460 AM, Shasta, Reading. And we're back. You are joining We the People Radio, mid-program here. We have Frank Gaffney on for another 10 minutes, so we're going to try to cram in all of our questions. If you want to join us online, it's WeThePeopleRadio.us, and that'll give you everything you need to know, and links to the Center for Security Policy with Frank Gaffney. So, okay, Frank, I told you during the break we had a lot of questions. Finances, cyber warfare. We talked a little bit about the idea of weakness and strength, and how that plays to these guys. So hit whatever you'd like in our last 10 minutes.
Well, the main thrust of this strategy, we call the Secure Freedom Strategy, again, modeled after President Reagan's successful one for defeating Soviet communism, is to do as he did, which is, if you're facing an existential threat from an enemy that seeks through the imposition of its totalitarian ideology to destroy your country and probably lots of its people. You need to deal with it as though it is an existential threat, which means to bring all instruments of national power to bear to defeat it. And what we laid out in that strategy document, which again is available for free at securefreedom.org, is a multi-part program. It starts with reconstituting our military capabilities. We don't want to have to use them, but there are places where we will, and where we do, we need to have the assured effectiveness of those forces so as to defeat the enemy. In addition, we want to reconstitute deterrence to those enemies who can be deterred, who we don't want to fight if it can be avoided, but who we want to make sure don't engage in aggression against us. Secondly, we have to understand that this is an ideological threat, and therefore, as Reagan did, we need to have an ideological or counter-ideological component to it. You may remember that he coined the phrase the evil empire, caricaturing and helping to delegitimate the Soviet Union and Soviet communism. We need a similar kind of approach. Information operations is another area where the Reagan strategy factored both a very strong defense of who we were and why what we are is superior to the enslaved peoples that find, whether they were the Soviet Union's own folks or whether they were those captive nations that they forced to conform to their agenda. And again, delegitimating them has to be part of what we do towards those who are now embracing and seeking to impose Sharia. Intelligence operations. We really used effectively, under then-director of Central Intelligence, William Casey, our intelligence services, both to collect intelligence, to understand what the enemy was up to, and to subvert it wherever we could. A similar kind of role has to be played by a reconstituted national intelligence community and capability. We also need, very importantly, to have an economic warfare element. President Reagan used this with decisive effect against the Soviet Union. We need to do it as well. We are facing economic warfare against us, by the way. The Saudis have said, most people don't know this, but the Saudis have said explicitly that their reason for manipulating oil prices, which many of us have benefited from, to be sure, but nonetheless, their purpose was to destroy our fracking industry. Well, that's an act of economic warfare. Then there are two other things that we talked about that really didn't feature in the Reagan agenda because they weren't so much in play at the time. One was the cyber threat. And you're absolutely right, this is huge. It is an asymmetric weapon of the first order. We need to understand what it involves, what our vulnerabilities are, notably. And this isn't the only way in which we're vulnerable, by the way, but it is a particular vulnerability, is of our electric grid. And that could be truly a nation-destroying threat if people who have been seeking to gain access to the control systems that manage the grid were successful in taking it down. That's one piece of it. There are many others, but we need to be on top of, and we need to be counteracting.
Well, there's been a lot of play on that electric grid here in the news in the last few months, because apparently we are very vulnerable as far as our electric grid.
Well, we are. In fact, not so far from you, back in April of 2013, mm-hmm. Some unknown number of folks broke into and shot up a facility that was essentially the key to supplying power to much of the San Francisco Bay Area, including Silicon Valley.
They never found those folks. I mean,
never found
those
guys.
Just a hit and run deal. Yeah, I mean,
you have to assume that they're still at large and could do it again.
Sure.
So yes, this is a really serious problem. It takes the form of cyber threats and physical attack and something called electromagnetic pulse attack as well, and also a solar phenomenon that even if none of our enemies do it to us, the sun will in due course. So for all these reasons, we need to be taking steps to protect our grid. The last thing is that, as we talked about at length at the beginning of the show, we're confronting a fifth column, which is much more formidable than anything Reagan had to deal with, and we need to understand it as well and take steps to counteract particularly the infrastructure the Muslim Brotherhood has been building in this country.
Yeah, because it seems like we just kind of let them operate over here. I mean, Sharia banking, things like that that we could, very easily shut down and make things at least a little bit difficult for them. But right now we aren't even addressing that.
Pretty much we are ignoring it. And when somebody calls attention to it, as did five members of Congress back in the spring of 2012, notably their leader, Michelle Bachmann, were excoriated. And by the way, not just by the Obama administration, but by people like John McCain and John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, and Mike Rogers, the Chairman of the Intelligence Committee. And the message was not lost on members of Congress, Republican as well as Democrat. You don't want to go anywhere near, probing into what is the true nature of the Muslim Brotherhood's influence operations and subversion in our country. And we cannot survive that. We have to start looking at it and counteracting it.
Well, if I was, if I were them and I wanted the perfect strategy, tie the politics to religion. Because in this country, if you offend somebody's religion, that's considered off topic. You know, you're not allowed to do that. So
right.
these guys tie everything to their religion when the bulk of it is political.
Yep. Well, you broke the code. And I think the beauty of focusing on Sharia, as we've talked about, is that you can talk about something that is fundamentally subversive and seditious and inconsistent with our Constitution and therefore illegal. And if we do focus on that, then I think we can actually work this problem domestically as well as internationally and hopefully in the process protect our country.
Do you see the mosque as a political place or a church place? And I know that's probably not a good yes or no question, but our feeling is that it's basically a political place posing as a church place.
Yeah. Again, it depends. If the mosque is embracing Sharia, then it is, by definition, going to view the mosque as a place of refuge, of course, and of religious training, but also an armory in which to train their battalions, and in some cases, actually, to cache their weapons. Now, there are other mosques that are not, conforming to Sharia, and I don't think this is true of them, but a study that was done by one of our colleagues, David Yerushalmi, identified this on the basis of an undercover investigation of a random sample of 100 mosques around the country. And they established that in roughly 80% of the mosques that they examined, there was empirical evidence of adherence to Sharia. And by the way, there was a correlation of 100% where they found Sharia being practiced with encouragement by those in the mosque to adherence to engage in jihad.
Oh, well, yeah, I guess 100% is kind of a telltale sign.
That's
kind of a clue. Yeah.
So what about the CARE guys? They're
I'm going to have to go, so I'll be very brief about this.
Sure.
In the document that we spoke of at the very beginning, the explanatory memorandum on the general strategic goal of the group in North America, which is, again, at our website, securefreedom.org. You can download it there for free. There is an appendix under the heading, Our Organizations and Organizations of Our Friends. Now, mind you, this was, again, a report back to headquarters in Egypt about how they were coming. They had at that time 29 groups they identified as either their organizations or organizations of their friends, including the Islamic Society of North America, which we've talked about, the Muslim Students Association, which we've talked about, the North American Islamic Trust, which we have not mentioned, but it is used to buy the mortgages of mosques and therefore create that kind of infrastructure that I was just talking about. One of the groups that you won't find on that list is something called the Council on American Islamic Relations, or CARE, which might induce some people to say, well, there you go, that shows that they are not a Muslim Brotherhood front organization. Unfortunately, that's not so. As I mentioned, this memorandum was written in 1991, and the Council on American Islamic Relations, or CARE, was not founded until 1993. We happen to know, however, that it is a Muslim Brotherhood front. In fact, it was created for the purpose of raising funds and doing political warfare on behalf of its Palestinian franchise, that terrorist group I mentioned earlier called Hamas. Because back in the day when the FBI still did this sort of thing, they wiretapped the organizational meeting of the Muslim Brotherhood's Council on American Islamic Relations in Philadelphia in 1993. And the transcripts of those conversations were also introduced into evidence in the Holy Land Foundation trial, and it makes that absolutely clear that this is a Hamas front and fundraising operation. And anyone who treats it as a civil rights organization, as it would have you believe, or anyone who thinks that it is on our side, the kind of good Muslim that we're looking for and reliable in helping us counter the bad Muslims, is being very badly misled. And I think, buying into this false narrative that is exceedingly dangerous for our country.
Well, thank you, because that's what we thought. But we thought we should speak with an expert.
My pleasure to talk with you as always, and look forward to doing so again. Thank you very much for allowing me to cut it a little short today, though.
No, of course.
We appreciate you coming on, Frank, and we'd love to have you back.
Thanks a lot.
Look forward to it. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Do we have to take a break?
Yeah, we do.
Oh, okay.
But I wanted to let people know before we did that, or while we were on break, if you go to wethepeopleradio.us, you will and you refresh the page for today's program, you will see that I put a big note. It says, read this document, an explanatory memorandum on the Muslim Brotherhood. It's right above Frank's picture. That'll take you directly to his site, directly to the document we've been referencing. My bad for not having it on there ahead of time. I didn't know it would be so. It's just the link has been a little bit screwy for people. So there you go. When we come back, we'll talk about other stuff. If you have things you would like to chat about, we're available at 530-605-4567. Or you can fire us something in the chat room either way. You're listening to KCNR 1460 AM.
The more you ignore me, the closer I get. You're wasting your time. The more you ignore me, the closer I get. You're wasting your time.
Misbehaving.
So in that vein, Bill's going to tidy up our segment here on the Muslim Brotherhood.
Well, Frank had mentioned in this memorandum which,
that we got from the Muslims.
Yeah, I mean they actually lined it out for us. One of the things towards the end is they list out organizations that are their friends and that are established here in the United States. And most of them have pretty obvious names, Islamic Teaching Center, the Association of Muslim Social Scientists, the Association of Muslim Scientists and Engineers, which is probably a pretty small organization there. But
they mostly work with pipe bombs, mostly.
Yeah, pipe bombs.
That's what they're engineering.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
But there's also some groups that, and this is why folks really need to do their homework when they get things in the mail and want to donate to good causes, because you might get one from Foundation for International Development. Gosh, that sounds like we're out building houses for poor people, doesn't it?
Kind of sounds like the UN to me, but okay, yeah. That's just me.
Yeah, it could be.
My international like flag went up.
Yeah, that's going right to the Muslim Brotherhood.
Blue helmet.
The American Trust Publications. Ooh, now there's one.
See, when
there.
You have to use trust in the name.
Yeah, don't trust it.
Maybe it's like a bank thing, though.
Yeah, don't trust it. Mercy International Association.
That kind of sounds Catholic, actually.
It does. It does.
So that sounds good, like the Mercy ships and all that.
Yeah. But, you know, I haven't
Mercy
seen
High School.
Mercy in much of anything that they're involved
yeah,
in.
Yeah, no, they're not big on that.
They're not big on Mercy. But, you know, if you get something from the Mercy International Association, check it out.
That would be the Muslim Brotherhood, a.k.a.
Yeah, that's right. How about the United Association for Studies and Research? Now, there's a nice organization there.
Because we want give them. We want them to study and research.
Oh yeah, we want to study and research. You know all the things.
Actually, anymore, people are kind of sick of paying for that, so maybe they don't.
Yeah, do your own studies.
Yeah.
Yeah. So basically, if you get this, get a copy of this because it really lines out the game plan, and it goes into great detail on where you, if you wanted to convert, where you could apply your trade and really help them out and or where they'll place you as far as what organization you could be the most help with your special skill sets.
Skills and talents.
Oh yeah. Everything from medical to engineering to teaching to youth groups. I mean, they have really got it covered in here. So get a copy of it, an explanatory memorandum from the archives of the Muslim Brotherhood.
You keep calling them the Muslim Motherhood.
The Muslim Motherhood.
I refrained from making fun of that earlier because I didn't want to take away
Frank's
time.
It's the mother of all
Muslims. Frank's gone. Now I can make fun of Bill. Under the bus.
Yeah.
The Muslim Motherhood.
I'd change their name because I can't say it.
That was pretty funny when you said it earlier, and Frank just let that go right by.
Yeah.
God love me, so serious.
Yeah, get a copy of it. It's really good reading, and it will answer any questions you have if you're in the least bit confused about their intentions in this country. So, with that.
Yeah, I think most people aren't. The problem is it's the religion tied to politics deal. And so then people are, they don't want to offend anybody. And, you know, okay, even though I can laugh all day long, but really and truly, it isn't. We don't make fun of other people's religion exactly. I mean, there are tons of good Catholic jokes, tons of good Jewish jokes, and usually the people of those faiths know the best ones. And so we typically take ourselves, you know, kind of, you know, lighthearted for that purpose, but we don't rip on them. I mean, that's considered rude.
Right.
And I get that. But the problem is these guys are using our social mores to enslave us in the future.
Yep. Securefreedom.org. That's where you can get all this good information.
That was super fun. Yeah. And we
Frank
will
Gaffney.
Have the archive of that put together by about 2:30 today. So if you missed the first half of it or any part of it, it'll be loaded on the website. And then our friend Robert will probably do one and pull out the couple of commercials that we had in there. And you'll have a commercial-free version. And it'll probably be just Frank. So you can actually cut us out, too, if you want. How about, Bob, do we owe the advertisers some extra commercial there? I think we do.
So, yeah, we can. Well, we can get them all in at 30 and 45. And
okay, all right. Let's do that. Because
use some broadcast jargon.
Yeah, at 30 and 45. This be at 30 right now. When we come back, got some good information for you on the Veterans Administration. So even if you don't live in California, you might listen up because it's probably happening at a Veterans Administration benefits office near you.
Or coming soon.
Oh. And they're probably doing it, you just don't know, but your veterans know all about it. They just feel the effects. So we'll have some good factual information for you on the VA when we come back. If you're listening to We the People Radio, join us online at wethepeopleradio.us here at KCNR 1460 AM.
Well, you filled up my head with so many lies. You twisted my heart till something snapped inside. I'd like to give it one more try, but my give a damn's busted.
Welcome back to We the People. That was fun, Bob. Who is that?
That's Chumbawamba with Tub Thumping.
It's a what?
Chumbawamba.
Okay, I've never heard of that.
The song is Tub Thumping.
Tub Thumping?
It was a huge number one hit in the 90s, which tells you where we were in the 90s.
I was busy. I think I was working. Like, I've never heard that before. It was fun, though. You have rejoined We the People Radio. Our phone number is 530-605-4567. You can join us online at the chat room or to get information about the program. Oh, the copy, somebody in the chat room, speaking of that, says, where do we get a copy of the list of organizations and stuff? We will have, that is actually, I was going to say we'll have to load that on the site, but we don't. The list of all the organizations that we read that are tied to the Muslim Brotherhood are in the memorandum that is on the Center for Security Policy. It's also linked on our site, an explanatory memorandum on the Muslim Brotherhood, right there on the March 8th page. So we the people... radio.us, and it's right there for you. So, we're going to segue here. Not much of a segue. It is kind of, though, I guess, because the Muslim Brotherhood, I think, is probably going to require some troops and some troop strength. So, when our folks come back, and if they have need of the VA and have to go through the benefits administration, we would like it to work properly. Unfortunately, we have kind of a huge problem, and it doesn't seem to work properly. Specifically, the Oakland Regional Office for Benefits. So we discovered back in, give people a teensy bit of history, back in 2012, because some employees at the VA last year spoke out. Back in 2012, these people popped up and said, hey, there are all these documents sitting in a cabinet, tons of them. And we think that there are claims that have been ignored for years and years and years. And they had been told repeatedly that, no, these are just extra files, just a myriad of excuses. Eventually, a woman from Washington, D.C. came out and looked into it, discovered that they were almost 14,000 actual claims from veterans dating back into the 1990s that had never been processed. Not good. So, some teams of people were put together at the VA to process those claims. Well, they discovered a lot of those veterans had passed away. Their families had never been contacted. That person never received the benefits they were entitled to, including things like it might be a home loan, CalVet loan. It might be an educational grant for their kids. There are many things besides just medical benefits that are available, including widow's pension, And none of that was done, obviously. So the employees that were processing the claims wanted to reach out to those people, and they were told by management not to. So this that had been brewing then for a couple of years. Last year, they reached out to the local congressional office of Congressman Doug LaMalfa and said, we need help, and we need to expose this, and these people need to have their claims gone through properly. We need to make sure that they all got what they had applied for and what was fair to them. So anyway, this took a long, slow trail through the Office of the Inspector General. So for people who haven't dealt with this kind of stuff before, every department of the federal government has an Office of the Inspector General. I used to think there was just one Inspector General kind of for the whole thing, and they were like jack of all trades. No. The VA Inspector General works with the VA. And so you have the Treasury Inspector General, and you have a bunch of different people. So the VA Inspector General went out last July, first part of August, for like almost 3 weeks, and finally released their report 2 weeks ago. So under the What We Found section, see, after 3 weeks and there's all this stuff going on, they write a report that's like 8 pages long, which was kind of depressing when we finally saw the outcome. It says, we substantiated the allegation that the Oakland regional office staff had not processed a significant number of informal requests for benefits dating back many years. By informal, it just means they weren't filled out on an official VA form. And what happens when someone files an informal claim is the VA's job, the law says they have to reach back out to that veteran, fill it out on a normal form, and start the process of a claim. So an informal claim is literally a claim, but they make a distinction there. It says, however, we could not confirm that the regional office staff processed all of the informal claims found in October 2012, nor could we confirm that the initial list contained 13,184 informal claims because of management's poor record-keeping practices. Yeah.
How convenient.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
So it goes on from there. I'm not going to read you the whole report just in case you're getting ready to stab a pen in your eye. thinking I was going to read you an 8-page report.
She read me the report, and I'm just healing up now.
I should have pointed that out early. So anyway, now fast forward to why it happened. That's always kind of fun. Why? Informal claims remained unprocessed because the Oakland Regional Office did not maintain adequate records regarding the unprocessed documents first discovered in the fall of 2012. The Regional Office Special Projects team did not complete its review of the documents discovered and, in some instances, incorrectly annotated no action necessary. And the people who worked on that team said, are you kidding? We begged to finish that project. And these are people who have actually lost their jobs or given them, retired early in some cases, because of this. So it isn't like they're just making this up. They paid a price for it. Okay, so now I'm going to scoot down to, oh, this was kind of a fun part too. Under the why it happened, a lack of management supervision over the review process also resulted in inadequate action on the informal claims. Okay, so management screwed up. They blamed it on some trainees. None of these people were trainees, which was interesting. It says, what resulted? This is how Inspector General reports come out. Now, let's look at like our whole government sort of in an overview. Congress makes laws. The agencies carry them out. The only thing standing between us and them is the Inspector General. There's DOJ and there's other stuff. But
the Inspector General is the one who can pass it on to DOJ
yeah.
if they find...
They put the screws to the agency, and they go look for things that are messed up, and they're in charge of fixing it. Congress can't make laws and enforce laws all at the same time, so people always want...
Thank God.
Yeah, it's not good. People want Congress to fire Lois Lerner and stuff like that. Well, you know, you can't do that. So here in their report, they also have a section called What Resulted. Because of inadequate processing actions and improper supervision of the trainees on the informal claims, veterans did not always receive consideration for benefits to which they may have been entitled. Further, regional staff should have sent formal applications for benefits, and they did not.
So they're admitting there that some veterans were entitled benefits and didn't get them.
Sure. And they also admitted in here, I mean, they just flat said, we substantiated the allegations that they did not process informal claims and improperly stored them. Because of poor record keeping, we could not verify the original document count of 13,184.
But see, a broom closet looks a lot like a filing cabinet. And
well,
so I kind of understand how that could happen.
You know what I discovered in my travels in the last few days is that... these were filed by month. Every single month, starting back in the 90s, when they came in the mailroom, they were like letters that might have been written in. I'm an Army veteran. I served from here to here in what region. Here's my Social Security number. Here's my name. That constitutes a claim. And they were like, it's not on the right paperwork, right? It's an informal claim. Mm. They gathered those up through the month, put them in a folder that said January 1992 or whatever, and then put them in this cabinet. They were all organized by
AKA
month.
Broom closet.
The broom closet was another batch of files.
Oh, that
actually,
was,
that's
oh,
different.
Sorry.
We don't want to mix up the broom closet and the filing cabinet.
The cabinet was where they kept the soap.
There was a broom closet filled with files that just were kind of a pain in the butt that went to, that was kind of the purgatory of claims, was a broom closet. We learned about that last year. And Bob, I've sent you an email with a link on it that we're going to want to play because We have multiple versions of this story, which is why I'm taking the time to do this today.
Which fascinates me because these folks all work for the same department pretty much, but they all have different versions of what transpired.
Well, and they're all at different levels of this whole thing.
So they don't even read their own reports
to
come up with a cohesive...
I do believe it's called comparing their stories. This has almost been like an interrogation where they're all in different rooms and you can see if you can get one to roll on the other one.
Yeah, well, they all roll on each other, but
well, because
not really.
The woman from Washington, D.C., whose name is Diana Rubens, was in a hearing, actually, back in it was July of last year, I believe, and the congressman was sitting there, saw her name, and asked her, "Hey, Mrs. Rubens," she was there for something totally different. He said, "Mrs. Rubens, do you remember going to Oakland and finding 14,000 unprocessed claims?" And she said, "Well, yes, I do." So she remembered it, even though the current management of the Oakland office didn't remember it. It was kind of just those two things never made sense. The recommendations, just so you know how Inspector General reports come out, this is pretty par for the course. "We recommend that the Oakland VA Regional Office Director complete the review of and take appropriate action on the remaining 537 informal claims and provide documentation to certify those new actions are complete," because they decided they still had 537 they could lay their hands on. Recommendation 2, "We recommend that the director implement a plan to provide training to staff on proper procedures," blah, blah, blah. So they definitely need more training, which really wasn't the problem. Recommendation 3, they recommend that the director implement a plan to ensure oversight of those staff assigned to process the informal claims. So stop putting them in folders and stuffing them in a cabinet.
Mm-hmm. And for crying out loud, don't put them behind the mop bucket because we'll never find them.
Exactly. Okay. So these three big recommendations, that was the...
anybody knows that.
That was the big deal. I sent it to you, Bob, right where the undersecretary starts speaking. So this was last week on Monday, and Congressman Barbara Lee actually was on an Appropriations Committee hearing for the Veterans Affairs Committee. They were doing some appropriation on facilities, and Barbara Lee had seen the CBS report. CBS did two, I mean, we kind of bash the mainstream media a lot, and sometimes for good reason, but CBS has been great at this. There's a guy named Wyatt Andrews who has been following this case, and he did two specials. After that, Barbara Lee saw those specials and decided to ask the Undersecretary of Veterans Affairs, General Allison Hickey, what she thought about that. And here's her commentary.
What station Mr. Paul Harvey used to talk about, but there is a much bigger rest of the story that I'd love to be able to present to you. First of all, the 13,184 pieces of paper they found were duplicate copies of an informal claim. It isn't even a real claim yet. It's a duplicate copy of an informal claim. They were in an old process that used to be done in VBA long before I got here. They used to make copies of things to keep track of them. And so those were the 13,184 pieces of paper put in the drawer. At the same time, those same 13,184 veterans came in with their formal original claim. We worked those all as they were coming in. They were not set aside. Those 13,000 copies were sitting in a drawer. The originals were being worked by the employees, the hardworking employees in the Oakland Regional Office, or as you well know, because we've talked about this, many other hardworking employees across the nation whom we brokered out or sent out that work. So no veteran was waiting on those 13,184 while they were sitting in a drawer. That was a copy. Second thing I would share with you is we did not misplace any of those 13,184. They were in that drawer. We discovered, because I sent in a help team to help Oakland, and when we found them, the employee did exactly the right thing, raised the issue and said, "There's 13,184 in there. We need to do something." They told us about it. I called the IG and said, "Full transparency, I want you to get in there and make sure what's going on with those 13,184," and they did. We set up special teams that took every one of those copies against the original file that we had already worked, and we matched every single one twice. A full 100% review of every single one against those copies of those informal claims to make sure we had it right. At the end of the day, we completed those two complete looks last September, on the 5th of September, and we found in the process of reviewing, there were about 403, to be exact, where we said, you know what, we probably could have made a better decision on those 403 claims than we did when we worked them, and so we made some adjustments. All of them are complete, none were missing, no malfeasance in that whole effort, no intention to hide anything. We just had those 13,000 copies over there. That practice has been discontinued. That practice was not a practice by the new director who is out there, who's doing a terrific job. And today, Oakland, by the way, backlog is down 70% from when we were visiting, when it was so bad in that same 2012-2013 time frame. They are doing much better. Their quality is up substantial. All the investments you helped us do to make them better are seeing good fruit.
I appreciate that, but then maybe...
Oh, I feel so much better now. That is the biggest crock of crap I've ever heard.
Can you say crock of crap?
You can say crock of crap, because that is a big lie. She needs a swing for that.
Oh, going all the way.
That is not right.
It's just stunning. So this is the thing I hope people are catching with this. If the little light hasn't gone off for you yet, 13,184
pieces of paper
is a very exact number. And for the Inspector General to say that they couldn't verify that and all that. So, you know, the question is, were they sitting in a room with this whirlwind of paper going 1, 2, 3, 13,183, 13,100? See, I don't think that happened. I think they were all on, say, an Excel spreadsheet, and you know what?
But 403.
But I was right. There is an Excel spreadsheet
that
does exist currently in two different locations.
But they're saying it doesn't exist.
No, they haven't really said that.
They can't find it.
They've stepped around that. No, they haven't.
It's filed incorrectly.
They're just kind of freaking out that now the jig is up. So our congressman's take on this is the VA just can't keep its story straight, and these dog ate my homework answers don't give me any confidence that these veterans will ever receive their benefits. First, we were told the claims had been processed, then that they were lost, and now that they never needed processing. These are three very different, mutually exclusive assertions about what happened at the Oakland office, and it raises more questions than it answers.
Well, there's vets out there that have died waiting for their claims to get heard. What about them?
Exactly.
What about them?
So the push is to get the list and actually verify that all the people on that list were handled. I'm sure some reapplied, you know, so some of those people probably did get handled, but
403, they could have done a better job on.
But don't you think it's funny? The Inspector General's report says 537. They worked on 537, and the Undersecretary says exactly 403. The whole thing is just crazy. And
they're just making it up as they go.
It's just not hard to... And then the whistleblowers provide yet a fourth view of that picture. And there was a team of six worked for 6 months on this batch of claims, and five of those people have come forward. So let's see, who do we believe? The folks who worked on it, who are veterans themselves, or the other cast of characters? So we better take a really quick break. We'll come back and... probably have more commentary. If you'd like to add to the commentary, or maybe you're waiting for your benefits and you'd like to just weigh in and be counted, it's 530-605-4567. Be right back. It's We the People Radio here at KCNR, 1460 AM. Good song.
Why did you lie to me? Just in good faith.
Yes, they would. They would lie to us. The most aggravating part is they lie to our veterans. And you know what? We aren't, you know, you hear it all the time, but we live in the land of the free and the home of the brave, and it's because of the brave.
I just can't believe they have the guts to sit there in a Senate hearing and spin these.
It's a House hearing, but, you know, still.
To spin a lie that's so far off base, they can't back it up, and they get away with it.
It remains to be seen if they get away with it.
Yeah,
I mean,
I agree.
It's, you know, if we're expecting a hole to open up in the floor and swallow them, you know, that's probably not going to happen. Although, you know, I would be a big fan of the trapdoor.
Well, I know somebody that's still working on it, and I think they're still going to get in trouble.
I think they're still going to get in trouble, too. Either that or going to run out of Bushmills. If all the Irish whiskey dries up, it might not finish. Oh, my gosh. But it is something that really... the benefits side of it, the benefits side of the VA is confusing for people. The healthcare side, everybody deals with healthcare. Everybody has to deal with a doctor and paperwork. And if you've ever had insurance, you've got to deal with an insurance company. And so those things are familiar to people. But the benefits administration part, that's confusing. And the VA makes it, you know, hard. We have a really good, in Shasta County, we have a very good Veterans Service Office. They are not the VA, by the way, for those people who think they are. They're over on Shasta Street, right across from the Black Bear Diner headquarters, kind of in the old, I think it's in the old library building or part of it. And those guys are great, and gals too. They help our veterans process claims, follow up on them, get all the paperwork squared away. But then they're at the mercy of Oakland to do that. Oakland takes care of everything north of, I'm going to say Monterey, might actually be a little farther south than that, but it handles a giant swath of territory. California actually has 25% of the nation's homeless veteran population.
Wow.
Yeah, and our little team here at We the People Radio was told by an employee at the Oakland regional office, who was in management at the time, that Oakland was in the habit, at least a year and a half ago, of denying the homeless claims when they came in, because only 40% of them reapply.
Hmm.
So
sweet.
California veterans.
Maybe that's why they're homeless.
Yeah.
Because
a lot of cases that's true.
Yeah. Oh yeah, they get hurt or they can't hold a job and then they don't get compensated and
they stall
where
them.
They end up.
Even if they get hurt, you know, I mean obviously they're hurt while they're serving.
Sure.
And they come back and things should be fairly seamless, and I know that there are long delays occasionally. So you have a Los Angeles benefits office, a San Diego one, and then Oakland regional office. So anyway, they're all having problems, and you're always hearing about the backlog, but sometimes you don't know what the backlog consists of. And
when she said they're 70%, what'd she say? They're 70% caught up now, or what? Well,
backlog was
70%
reduced.
Of what? I mean, how many claims are they still hanging out there?
Well, it's also come to the notice of the We the People staff that a lot of the backlog claims have been moved into a series in their computer called correspondence. So they're being held like letters that were written to the VA, but they're really claims. So they'll never be processed there.
Mm.
And one employee, I believe, mentioned a few weeks ago that was well over 10,000 files in the correspondence section.
Mm. In the words of our commander-in-chief, what a bunch of jackasses.
Nice. Bill's feeling kind of vindictive today.
Oh, it's so frustrating to hear. I mean, these people are at the highest levels of our government, and they're playing these games with us.
Absolutely.
It's criminal.
When you look at it, the undersecretary, right, is overseen by the secretary. Now that would be Mr. McDonald, who...
Oh, is that the one that was a special forces but got confused and he really wasn't?
The faux special forces guy?
Yeah.
Yes.
He's kind of like special forces.
Now, he's appointed by the president. So this all flows directly down through the executive branch. So for people that are thinking about sitting out the next presidential election, or who have bought into the idea that all of them are the same, all of our presidents are exactly the same, yes, there are a lot of bad policies that travel back and forth between the Republicans and the Democrats. I would never tell you that. Well, no one should ever tell you that there is one party that always does the right thing, because that's silly. It's all about people. However, if you are the same party affiliation as the person in the executive branch at the top of the food chain in the president's chair, you have a higher likelihood of influencing, higher likelihood that you will be able to influence who sits in these agencies.
Sure.
And they actually will work with you a little bit. At this particular point, office up here in the 1st Congressional District would be a Republican office, and haven't had any great open door sessions going on, even with all of this. But we do have a lot of veterans who do care. We have a lot of people who support our veterans. Everyone's family, for heaven's sakes. Who has a family that doesn't have anybody in their system that is a veteran, has served at some point? So we salute all you guys and gals, and we know that if you're waiting on benefits, that it's a grind. But just want you to know, people do care, and they are looking into it. And I will post that information on the website for the people that are madly refreshing and looking for it. It's not there yet, but I'll do it as soon as we get off the air. So, another happy episode of We the People Radio, wrapping up. Oops.
Sorry.
Or Angry Radio, where blood shoots out of your eyes. We're sorry. Thanks, Bob. Thanks, Bill.
Thanks, Aaron.
Thank you, Aaron. Outstanding show today.
See you kids next week. I forget what we're doing next week, but it'll be fun. You'll like it. Let you roll, Mary.